Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I am thrilled to have with me today a return visit from Dr. Deb Schwangel, who is one of our pediatric anesthesiologists and a really fantastic teacher, always perennially one of our best teachers here at Hopkins. And we are going to talk this time about pediatric OSA. Deb, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Before we hop in, I want to point out that this episode is going to be featured on anesthesiologynews.com. It's a great website, as listeners know from prior episodes. They feature really great content about anesthesiology. You can check out all their news and content and archives at anesthesiologynews.com. I get no financial support from them whatsoever, by the way, so this is not a plug to try to sell anything, and it's a free publication, but it's really well done. So check it out, and you'll see this episode featured there as well. All right, so Deb, let's jump in and talk about pediatric obstructive sleep apnea. So give me the basics. How common is this? We think about it certainly in adults. Is it common in kids too?
It is fairly common in kids, probably a little less so than in adults, but with the number of obese children rising in the world and the country, it is a prominent feature of obese patients. It tends to be about 1 to 6% of children. The number depends on which publication you read. Adults, perhaps more like 25%, and bariatric patients probably more like 70%.
Okay, and I would assume that obese children are more likely than all-comer children to have OSA.
Exactly, and also they're less likely to be cured by a tonsillectomy compared to children who are not obese.
Interesting. Okay. Do we know why?
Just because of all of the comorbidities of obesity.
Right. So it's not just the tonsils. There's everything else that's going on.
Correct.
Okay. Interesting. So what exactly is this, especially in these kids where the tonsillectomy itself doesn't cure it? It's not just obstruction. So are there other things going on?
Yeah. It used to be that we thought OSA was purely a mechanical thing. And now we know that it is much more than that. It is really a multi-system disorder. And so because of that, some people call this OSAS, obstructive sleep apnea syndrome, because it is really an immune disorder. It has cardiovascular, central nervous system, as well as metabolic effects.
Okay. And so are these kids more likely to have other congenital abnormalities, or no, it's not related?
They may. And so when a little later, I think we'll get into the way that some of the patients present, and the age differences do matter in terms of what comorbidities there may be.
Okay, great. Now, are there different subtypes of OSA or OSAS?
Yeah, so we kind of talk about four phenotypes, and traditionally, the kids that were more prominently presented were those with large lymphoidal tissues. So big tonsils and adenoids, clearly they lead to obstruction, mostly because these kids have a lot of lymphoid tissue growth compared to the size of their airways. Mm-hmm. And so just really an imbalance there. And so that's the traditional 2 to 8 year old kind of patient with OSA. But then the obese patients are really becoming coming to the forefront as being the main phenotype related to OSA. But kids with craniofacial disorders are more prominent in the younger age groups, and then kids with neuromuscular disorders are at risk throughout their lives, potentially.
Okay. Now, let me ask you about the obesity subtype, which, as you said, these days with more and more obesity in children is becoming more common. Do you know if they lose enough weight, do they lose the OSA, or is that not necessarily a cure?
I think that is a topic that needs more investigation.
Okay.
And I think, yes, there is a potential that they will. as opposed to just staying on CPAP or something like that, which children don't do very well with.
Right.
Like some adults, there are going to be some patients who have a genetic predisposition to having OSA.
Right, because of course there are some thin adults who have OSA.
Right, and the thinking about the immune modulation of all of this is that you get kind of a positive feedback cycle. So which comes first? It's the chicken or the egg kind of thinking. Is it the metabolic stuff that comes first and leads to OSA? Does OSA come first and lead to obesity? We don't really know in all patients.
Interesting. Okay. Let's talk about the pathophysiology. So what is actually going on here?
Well, so clearly there's obstruction at some level in the pharynx, and because of lymphoidal tissue, that may be worse in some kids. But compared to adults, we know a few things about sleep study differences and physiologic differences. Kids are a little stiffer airways, and so they're a little less likely to completely collapse like adult airways do. And so when you're doing investigation to find out about whether a patient has obstructive sleep apnea, namely a sleep study, the pediatric patients are more likely to have hypopneas, which are partial airway collapse leading to gas exchange abnormality. And so that's a more prominent feature of children's OSA than adults. Another difference is that the events are really stage specific. So kids tend to have their obstructive events more during REM sleep, and adults can have that a little less specifically during a particular sleep cycle. We talked a little bit already about kids just in general having smaller airways, and so that any kind of addition of any kind of tissue, such as lymphoidal tissue, obese tissue, or any deposition disorders like mucopolysaccharidosis or something like that, will lead to more airway obstruction. The other thing is about OSA that you can get some dysfunction, neurologic dysfunction with central nervous system regulation of tissues as well as response to CO2. And so there may be some dysfunctional neuromuscular responses to airway pressures as well as a decreased arousal threshold to hypercarbia.
And is that because they get accustomed to it? They are common. They are sort of more commonly experiencing hypercarbia, and so they kind of their body adjusts. They have some renal compensation, like adults do. Or
I think it's more of a real sort of a remodeling or dysfunction in the CNS.
Okay,
not just a hydrogen ion kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
But it may be some of both. We do know that their central nervous system neurons are different.
Okay. And are there genetic predispositions to OSA?
Certainly. Some families do seem to have a predisposition, and so you'll see subsequent children in a family coming for tonsillectomy and because they seem to have the same gene, apparently,
right.
That their parents do or their siblings do. And also, we know that African-American children may be more at risk as well.
Are there other – so we know obesity, obviously, a big risk factor. African-American race, it sounds like, is a risk factor. And there may be some other things. I think we'll get into diagnosis in a minute. You mentioned the immune system probably plays a role. Is there a way in which this is an inflammatory disorder?
Yeah, we know that there are elevations in pro-inflammatory cytokines, and asthma is a similar kind of disorder in that there is an inflammatory component. And this is another positive feedback loop where asthma makes OSA worse. OSA potentially makes asthma worse as well.
All right, great. So let's talk about the diagnosis itself. How is this diagnosed in children?
Well, the gold standard is a polysomnogram, and so otherwise known as a sleep study. That is not necessarily the best gold standard, however, because there are a lot of problems in conducting it. It is an expensive test. You have to sleep in somebody else's bed with all kinds of things attached to you. So some patients just do not sleep very well. And so when we're talking about children, if you can't even get them into REM sleep, you haven't done a very good test. And so that's a problem. Also, in rural areas of the country, there may not be a sleep lab and certainly not a pediatric sleep lab. And so we end up with scoring that may be a little bit less reliable if they haven't scored for hypopneas.
Right. Okay. And so it's interesting because specifically, like you said, this tends to happen in REM sleep with kids. So you really have to get them into REM sleep, whereas adults, maybe it's less dependent on what stage of sleep they're in.
Yeah, although anybody who doesn't sleep in the sleep lab hasn't gotten a good study.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I can't imagine trying to sleep with all those wires and who knows what else attached to you, right? And
yeah, I don't think it would be a very pleasant night.
So in theory, if you see the hypopneas, then you've got your diagnosis. But if you don't, it doesn't mean that they don't have OSA. It may be that they didn't sleep well enough.
Correct. Now, they can also have discrete, complete obstructions, too. I didn't want to leave you thinking that they only have hypopneas.
Right.
But they're more adults are less likely to have hypopneas.
Great. All right. So polysomnography is the gold standard but has some serious issues. So we obviously don't send any kid who we're worried about for polysomnography before taking them to the OR. Are there other things we do? Do we use, for example, stop bang with kids?
Yeah. I think we should discuss all of that. Stop bang may apply to some of the older kids a little bit, but it's clearly not something that's suitable for the youngest kids. But it's an important question to raise. And so one of the ways I like to teach about how can we screen children is to actually go through stop bang and talk about which components of stop bang are useful in children. And so the S, which stands for snoring, is a useful tool to use. And so I think it's an appropriate screening question for all patients who come to the operating room, regardless of age. And if the patient's parents say the child snores, then you can dig into that a little bit in depth. So if the child only mildly snores and doesn't snore every night of the week, we don't worry about it so much. But if they say, oh, yeah, this kid snores like a truck driver, we can hear him through the closed door every night of the week,
right,
then I want to say, okay, well, tell me more. Does the child have breath-holding episodes? Do you worry about whether your child is moving air? Does he or she sleep in a funny position where they seem to be extending the airway to try to maximize airflow? Are they diaphoretic during sleep? And do they have any of the other things that we tend to think about in patients who don't sleep well? And those are that is a little different in kids than adults. So when we talk about the T, which stands for tiredness in adults, little kids may not exhibit daytime fatigue.
Sure. Other than at nap time.
Yeah. Right. But every parent who has a kid who doesn't sleep understands that kids who don't sleep get kind of mean.
Yeah.
And they have behavior problems.
Right.
And so if the child is sometimes hyperactive, not doing well in school, is really a difficult child, maybe you should investigate whether sleep is a problem for them.
Right.
Enuresis is another thing that can be seen.
Okay.
And then the observed apneas, certainly they can be a reliable thing to look for in children as well as adults. The problem is if you're expecting these events during REM sleep happens at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. Not all parents are awake to watch that.
Right.
But if a parent tells me, I'm really worried about my child, I sleep with my child because I'm so worried about how he or she sleeps, that tells me a lot.
Yeah.
And so that's probably because they are seeing these kinds of things.
Right.
The P stands for pressure, hypertension. In general, you don't do a blood pressure monitoring during a sleep study because it would wake up the patient. But there are some studies out there that suggest that there is probably a pressure-related phenomenon that occurs at night in children as well as adults. It just because they're cardiovascular system is in general healthier, they may not show hypertension during the day. But there are some studies out there that have shown that there are some kids, even with probably only moderate sleep apnea, that may have some septal shift in their heart, which may indicate that they do have nocturnal hypertension.
Interesting.
And that may be occurring in some of these kids, and we just don't know about it.
Okay.
And then the BMI, is relevant because you have obese children as well as obese adults, and we know that it is related. The age is an area, though, where we have to talk more.
Right.
So clearly, the older adults have more of a risk of having OSA. Children, I like to categorize into three different groups. One group is the less than 2-year-olds, and those I think are if they have OSA, they're more likely to have craniofacial problems, neuromuscular problems. Perhaps they were a premature infant, which led to some craniofacial modeling. We know that intermaxillary distance may make them a little bit more at risk of having OSA. And so those kinds of things are probably particularly pertinent to the less than 2-year-olds.
Okay.
The 2 to 8-year-olds are the age, again, where you have the lymphoidal hypertrophy that just pretty much outstrips the size of the airways. And so those are the kids who may be best cured by a tonsillectomy. And then the greater than 8-year-olds are more likely to have adult-style OSA. They're more likely to be obese, probably some genetic predispositions as well. But that can go along with the other age groups too. And so you tend to look for more of things like metabolic syndrome in this age group. And so these kids can be screened perhaps a little bit more like adults, and I believe somebody is working on an older kid stop bang tool.
Okay.
And then neck circumference. Again, if you have an obese child, probably have a bigger neck. I mean, like adults, if you have a neck versus no neck, it probably matters to their OSA. Probably also matters to their airway management.
Presumably, the same cutoff measurement is not going to be the same for kids.
Right, because they're going to be smaller. But, I mean, if you have a 17-year-old who has a neck circumference over 40, then I'd be concerned.
Yes, that's significant. Okay.
And then the gender, we do think in the older age group kids that male gender is relevant.
Okay. So, good. So, a lot of good things in that stop being still to use. And so do you guys routinely use that to evaluate kids coming in for surgery?
Well, not really so much because we're dealing with a lot of 3- and 4-year-olds. Mm-hmm. But I like to start with the snoring as the initial screening question and then dig into more about the parents' concern. We do know that questionnaires that have been produced are not perfect. Mm-hmm. Just like Stop Bang isn't perfect, but it is an awareness tool.
Right.
And I think one of the real take-home messages here is that you have to have an awareness. And so you're a little more aware if the child is coming for a tonsillectomy, but what if the child is not coming for a tonsillectomy? You still need to screen for OSA because you may be using potent medications that could put them at risk in the postoperative period. So you need to have some kind of mechanism for determining if your patient is at risk. And so snoring is a reasonable way to start. The other thing about questionnaires is that they may have some sensitivity and specificity for determining whether somebody has OSA, but they're not at all studied or proven to show anything about perioperative risk. So you have to be smart about that. You know,
right.
You really have to be a suspicious anesthesiologist when you're talking about this stuff with your patients and deciding if you have the sense that your patient is at risk or not.
Absolutely. And then what about home oximetry? Is that helpful?
So the group in Montreal has done a lot of work with this. And so serial nocturnal oximetry probably is helpful. The challenge, like many, is that you have to have a system that has that available, is set up for people to use, and then you have to download the data and analyze it. So it probably is relevant. And so they've produced some research to suggest that if people are chronically hitting saturation nadirs less than 80 to 85, that they're at risk, and that's probably severe disease. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about how severe pediatric OSA is, with a sleep study, the numbers are lower than adult studies. So we consider a number of 1 to 5 to be mild.
And what is that referring to, the 1 to 5?
That's the AHI or the RDI, so the apnea hypopnea index or the respiratory disturbance index.
And what is that? So that is that has to do with the number of kind of hypopneic or desaturation episodes?
Correct. So they're the number of events scored in an hour.
Okay.
And that is correlated also with a saturation of greater than 92.
Okay. So mild is 1 to 5 events per hour and – or, I guess, and a saturation greater than 92%.
Correct. And then moderate AHI, RDI in children is 5 to 9, and there's not really a saturation that's defined for that category. And then severe is an AHI, RDI of 10 or greater, and saturations in that 80 to 85 range below that, we would be considering them to be severe.
Okay, so you can meet the criteria by low saturations or by meeting your number of events per hour.
Correct. And also there's usually some capture of end-tidal CO2. Mm-hmm. And so if that's high, that may be another factor that you want to pay attention to in determining what the disposition of your patient is going to be after surgery.
Great. All right, so let's talk. Now we've talked about how to diagnose these kids and the different ways that are used to kind of figure out who's at risk. So let's talk about the management perioperatively. What are you keeping in mind? How are you managing these kids to keep them as safe as possible?
Right. Well, again, the first challenge is to know who has it and to be very, very suspicious in patients who have risk factors like obesity, Down syndrome, former preemies, craniofacial disorders, hypotonic kids, and abnormal airways. One of the challenges with hypotonic kids that I didn't mention when we were talking about snoring is the hypotonic kids might not generate noise. So snoring might not be a good enough screening question for them.
Interesting.
We know that kids with Downs are probably 70 to 80% of them have obstructive sleep apnea. Mm-hmm. So we just assume they have it pretty much, and they're considered patients at risk who should be kept overnight.
Okay. All right. And so then you want to keep in mind, as you said, who might have it. You probably won't have polysomnography on most of these kids, but you want to have an idea in your head. Who do I think is at risk? And then if you think a kid's at risk, how are you going to actually try to avoid causing them harm?
Right. Well, so we know that opioids are a risk for these patients, and that has been shown in a number of studies. Again, the Montreal group has done a lot of research there. And so we think that their sensitivity is such that they should only be given half of the normal dose of morphine. Most of those studies were done with morphine. So if you would consider giving 0.1 milligrams per kilo to your patient, and you know they have severe obstructive sleep apnea, they should only get 0.05 milligrams per kilo.
Okay.
And that is a board question now. So you have to know, not necessarily that dose, but to give a reduced dose of opioid to these patients. So it's also, I think, important to think about, can you use modalities that are going to be likely to maintain an open airway, so regional, avoiding opioids again. Dexmedetomidine tends to maintain airway patency, and so you want to also consider using more acetaminophen or ibuprofen, although there's a lot of controversy with surgeons about whether using NSAIDs really increases the risk of perioperative bleeding mm-hmm. in tonsillectomy patients. So tonsillectomy patients have two main risks. One of them is airway obstruction mm-hmm. after surgery, and the other is post-tonsillar hemorrhage.
Yep.
So both can be fatal, and so you have to be cautious about both of them. So I think now after in this day and age, less and less opioid is given to these patients when they go home, and more NSAIDs in countries other than the United States, NSAIDs have been used pretty extensively with a good safety record. I think the main teaching now, though, is that, of course, aspirin is absolutely forbidden in these patients. It's definitely a risk because it kills your platelets for 9 days. It makes them just incapable of creating an adequate clot.
Right.
And then no ketorolac in immediate perioperative period. But we do tend to send kids home with ibuprofen orally after hemostasis is achieved.
Okay. Are there other medications that you use or don't use to try to optimize these kids?
Yeah, so dexamethasone has been studied a little bit, although there hasn't really been a really clarifying dose-finding study to determine which is the best dose of that to use. There was a great study some years ago about the best dose for post-op nausea and vomiting, and that clearly showed the small dose was just as effective as the large dose. But the same kind of study has not been done related to pain mm-hmm. and tonsillectomy. But the Montreal group, again, had created an algorithm or actually a recipe to use for these patients where they used half of the dose of morphine and an increased dose of dexamethasone. And we know that dexamethasone has some pain-related effects. It just hasn't been studied clinically as well as we might like for this patient population. So they use 0.3 milligrams per kilo in their plan for their patients. And so that's what we have adopted as well. And so we think that dose of dexamethasone is probably going to help create better pain profile after surgery.
Okay, great. And then I assume you're not really using codeine anymore?
We are definitely not using codeine anymore. It's a black box warning from the FDA. And the reason for that is that it's really a prodrug. And there's a lot of genetic variation in metabolism, which is dependent on the CYP2D6 enzyme. And we know there can be variability there, but what has been proposed in a few deaths is that there were some patients who were hyper-metabolizers of codeine, and so the patient got a normal dose of codeine, but then they get too much liberation of morphine in their bloodstream, and therefore they end up with essentially an overdose.
Right. Okay. So important to keep in mind. And then we talked before, I think you mentioned that these patients can actually be difficult airways. So what do you, how does that play out, and how do you try to avoid any complications from induction and intubation?
So a lot depends on whether this is a craniofacial disorder, an obesity disorder, or this is really just big tonsils. The patients with big tonsils can be managed usually pretty well with a standard inhaled induction. Just knowing that they are likely to obstruct, however, on induction we use CPAP. And are plan to do that early in the induction phase, and then once the patient is deep enough, then placement of an oral airway is very effective. And so, typically for the standard tonsillar hypertrophy patient, that works very well. If a patient though has extreme severity of their disorder, and we have a sleep study that shows they have maybe an RDI of 60 or something like that,
right,
I'll put an IV in first.
Okay.
Because you just want to bypass that stage of airway obstruction that's going to happen with inhaled agents by just using a faster induction agent like propofol.
Now, do you ever do awake intubations, especially in like the craniofacial abnormality kids?
Typically, children don't tolerate that.
Yeah, I would imagine.
It's a much more difficult thing to consider in a small child. Potentially, in a teenager, you can. But now that we have good intravenous agents that we can use to maintain breathing, like dexmedetomidine or propofol as an infusion, we usually will just slowly titrate up our infusion to maintain respirations and then have all of our airway support devices in the room and maybe our surgeons to help if we think that we might have a significant airway problem.
Okay. Great. And then what about post-operatively? So do these kids all need to stay in the hospital or can they go home, some of each?
So some of each. So in general, the severe kids need to stay. So the challenge is, well, what if you haven't gotten a sleep study and you really don't know how severe their disease is?
Yeah.
Then we tend to say, well, if I think that it's severe and I think the patient is going to need opioids, I'm going to keep them. The other things to look at are the risks of persistent disease after tonsillectomy. So not everybody gets cured with a tonsillectomy, although you might make a patient improved. Let's say you're taking care of an obese patient and they're in the severe range. Taking out their tonsils might move them to the mild or moderate range of disease. However, you don't get instantly cured the day of surgery. It takes several weeks for the tissues to adapt to not having the big tonsils there,
right,
for some edema to go away and all of that. And so if the patient has any risk after all of the tonsillectomy is done, then we keep them. So the obese patients, the Down syndrome patients, the neuromuscular patients, craniofacial, severe asthma, other significant comorbidities would indicate that they would stay.
Okay.
And usually that's just a 23-hour stay. We just want to make sure they do okay through the night, their pain is adequately managed, and they can drink and stay hydrated, because one of the risks for post-tonsillar hemorrhage is dehydration.
Right.
The clot tends to – the scab tends to fall off prematurely, and then you end up with bleeding a week later.
Right.
Other kids who need to be admitted are those less than 3 years of age. Probably for two reasons. One is their airways are smaller, and the other is that when the younger you are with OSA, the more likely you may be to have craniofacial disorder or some other kind of a disorder like a neuromuscular one. We already talked about severity being an indication for staying, and then uncontrolled pain is a reason to keep the patient as well.
Sure. So patients who are older than three, no major comorbidities, and just have mild to moderate disease are, we think, safe to go home.
Correct. But again, we're careful with still with how much opioid they're going to go home with.
Right.
We think that a lot of this thinking about OSA is happening out there. Unfortunately, we still see a number of deaths happening every year. And these are really preventable deaths, and so this is an unmitigated tragedy.
Yeah, absolutely. So in adults, at least at our institution, and any adult who scores high on the stop-bang score or who has known OSA, post-operatively from any surgery in the PACU, they have to pass a room air trial. So they have to be able to maintain their saturations above, I believe, 92% while on room air before they're allowed to leave the PACU. And if they can't do it, they have to spend the night in the PACU so that they can have continuous monitoring. Is that true? Do we do the same thing with kids or not?
We don't have a similar protocol for kids, but we do monitor them with a pulse oximeter. Many of them do stay in the PACU overnight. That's our 23-hour stay unit.
Okay.
Some of them, though, will go to the floor, and they'll usually have a pulse oximeter on all night.
Okay, great. Anything else we left out?
I think we covered a lot.
I think we did, too. Thank you so much for coming back on the show.
It's a pleasure.
All right, that was great. Let us know if you take care of kids in the OR, and if so, how you handle the kids with OSA. Do you use the same kind of screening tools that Dr. Schwengel talked about, or do you have others that you think would be useful to share? If so, go to ACRAC.com, where you can leave a comment and see this as well as all of our episodes. Comments are great because others can learn from what you have to say as well. You can, of course, also contact me at ACRAC@ACRAC.com. If you're a fan of the show, consider going to iTunes and leaving a comment and a rating. It helps others find the show. And if you'd like to support the making of the show, go to patreon.com/ACRAC. That's patreon.com/ACCRAC, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two, it makes a big difference, and we really appreciate it. Special thanks, as always, to Brian Park for making fantastic outlines for many of the episodes, and to all of you who are already patrons on Patreon. We couldn't do it without you. That's it for today. For the ACRAC podcast and Dr. Deb Schwengel, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.